So last night, James Cordova gave a beautiful talk on the following passage, one that I'd also been sitting with, and I wanted to continue looking into it tonight. The passage goes like this from the Record of Master Linji, and this is the translation from Thich Nhat Hanh that we've been using. The Master taught, "In these times, whoever studies the Buddha Dharma needs right view. Once there is right view, birth and death can no longer touch you. At that point, whether you stay or go, you do so as a free person. You do not need to go in search of the transcendent, but the transcendent will seek you out." So a few things about this passage. I emailed it to a friend of ours who is, I would say, in the middle stages of a fairly serious disease. And I know that he's dealing with issues around life and death, around losing certain capacities, which most of us are lucky to lose gradually as we get older, but he's losing them much faster because of this disease. And he wrote back to me about these lines saying that they speak his mind completely. This is a person who's not a Zen practitioner, but a very deeply spiritual and religious person in another tradition. Birth and death can no longer touch you. This can be just idle speculation, or it can seem like a good idea. But when death is approaching in this slow motion way that it does with some kinds of disease progressions, it can be very reassuring, and my friend was reassured to hear birth and death can no longer touch you, because he understood what it means at a deeper level. That no matter what's happening, this is what's happening. His wife wrote to me and said she can't believe how cheerful he is. She said, "I'm not cheerful about this." But he is in the position of only being able to surrender, whereas she and we are in the position of maybe thinking it could be different. And this next line, "At that point, whether you stay or go, you do so as a free person." This is the kind of freedom that Linji is pointing to, and the kind of freedom that our friend is discovering. When there are certain things that are just impossible, there's a kind of freedom in this. Again, we only know it when we're pressed against the wall. If we think about it intellectually, we can speculate all we want. But when the actual matter is at hand, when we feel our limitations, then knowing what it means to be free in the middle of those limitations is quite powerful. And then, of course, this last line, which I find so amazing. You do not need to go in search of the transcendent, which is what so many of us are trying to do. And even those of us who have seen through this particular delusion, definitely it was one of the reasons why we started Zen practice in the first place, going in search of the transcendent. But to know that this is not our business, that we do not have to keep going into the world trying to make things a certain way. To learn this lesson before we have to face a critical illness is a real gift of this practice. To learn it thoroughly, to realize that what Thich Nhat Hanh says in this translation, the transcendent will seek you out. The world is actually, on some level, and I don't mean this that the world has a personality that's doing things on an intentional level, but that this bodhicitta, this wisdom heart that runs the universe, only wants to express itself. It only wants to live through us. It's coming all the time. Dogen speaks about this when he says that delusion is going out to meet the things of the world, and awakening is receiving the 10,000 things. we become giant receivers, or some of us small receivers, of this life energy, which just wants to be realized. So I was so taken with this line that I wanted to see what it might have been in the original, because we have a whole bunch of translations that David and I have bought through the wonders of Amazon and the interweb. And we have them in a little library for the people who are giving talks so that we can consult them. And I looked in all the versions and I didn't find anything that remotely looked like this. In fact, here's a translation of the same passage from Ruth Fuller Sasaki, a wonderful book that that was published many, many years ago and that has been revised by Thomas Kirchner, who's a great modern Zen practitioner and translator. So here's another version of what Linji said. The master addressed the assembly, saying, "Followers of the way, it is urgently necessary that you endeavor to acquire true insight and stride boldly here under the heavens, not losing your senses owing to that bunch of spirits." This is Sasaki's version of whoever studies the Buddha Dharma needs right view. This striving boldly, very interesting. And then he goes on to say, "He who has nothing to do is the noble one." And I think maybe that some of this, "he who has nothing to do is the noble one," according to Kirchner, this is a very difficult line to translate in Chinese, from the Chinese. It actually has the sense of, you don't have to do anything, things will come to you. The one who is the noble one, the one who is practicing diligently this way, becomes a receiver, has nothing to do. So it's wonderful to see how widely variant these interpretations are, and yet if we boil them down to the essential, the essence matter, they're basically saying, cut it out. Stop striving. Stop trying to search after some idea of awakening. There's nothing to do. You are a free person, in Thich Nhat Hanh's translation. There is nothing to do. The noble one has nothing to do. And then he says in the Sasaki version, simply don't strive. This is after saying, it's urgently necessary that you endeavor to acquire true insight and stride boldly here under the heavens. Simply don't strive. I love that. How do we do them? How do we bring them together? Well, you know, the power of our intention is so strong, but striving is something else altogether. Making the decision to come here to this coming and going session, either for a few days, a few weeks, or a few hours, is an example of endeavoring to take the path. Even listening to this talk, if you're listening to it online, just enough to say, I will listen to this talk right now. And then you are actualizing your endeavor. But striving, simply don't strive. And then the opposite of this, the rest of the sentence is, just be ordinary. Simply don't strive, just be ordinary. Sounds so easy. Not so easy. Not so easy to understand, not so easy to actualize in our lives. And then he ends this little section, yet you look outside, searching side paths and seeking help. You're all wrong. A slightly different kind of translation. In looking into this, I found that this translation, "He who has nothing to do is the noble one," which can be expressed in so many different ways, comes from an old poem that was familiar to any Chinese person living in the Tang or the Song dynasty. It was written in the early Tang, and so Kirchner thinks maybe Lin Ji read it. And I want to read you that poem because I find it quite inspiring. It was attributed to a teacher named Sang Zhao, who was fairly famous, but it was probably, according to Kirchner, written by a scholar monk who was learned in Chan, and then credited it to Sang Zhao in order to assure its recognition. This would be like if we wrote a book and pretended that the Dalai Lama wrote it instead. So, you know, really, no, it wasn't Melissa Blacker who wrote this book, but the Dalai Lama, oh, did you hear what the Dalai Lama came up with recently? And then it would spread. This anonymous scholar monk just wanted his words to get out there. He didn't care if his name got affixed to them, and they didn't. But here's the poem, which in Chinese apparently rhymes. The very way is without roots, empty, clear, yet ever existent. The very way is without substance, obscure, mysterious, yet ever real. The very way is without anything to do, yet from past to present, worthy of esteem. The very way is without mind, yet the 10,000 things are embraced within it. Hence the way is without characteristics, without form, without anything to do, without intent, without mind, yet excellently it benefits all things. So this idea that there is something that fills the universe, that can be experienced by us without striving for it, that is energetically oriented to coming towards us. I find this very reassuring. I find that this admonition to not do anything, which is in this poem and in both versions of the translation to some extent, to learn how to accept the transcendent when it arrives at our door, to learn how to accept this life as it is, even if it's not taking the form that we thought it would, even if all of our hopes and dreams have been crushed and trampled upon by the shocks of an ordinary human life. Still, we can turn ourselves, in whatever condition we find ourselves, towards this great way. This great way that's without roots and without substance, that's without mind and without characteristics and without form, that's without intent and without mind. Yet excellently, it benefits all things. The master taught, in these times, whoever studies the Buddha Dharma needs right view. Once there is right view, birth and death can no longer touch you. At that point, whether you stay or go, you do so as a free person. You do not need to go in search of the transcendent, but the transcendent will seek you out. He who has nothing to do is the noble one. Simply don't strive, just be ordinary. You who look outside, searching side paths and seeking help, you're all wrong. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue.
Thank you, Melissa. I love the phrase about the transcendence being energetically oriented toward coming toward us, you know. And so reassuring that is, you know, both from the reading that we've been doing of Linji And in our experience here in this Zendo and in this coming and going sesshin, you know, this delicious food arrives every meal. Just, it's unbelievable. And and the lights go on and someone puts these books on our cushions for us. And, you know, everything always, without, you know, striving, arrives and becomes part of our experience of living. And just to have faith, and not just faith, but to actually pay attention to and experience how that happens, you know. So the transcendence seems like it's some sort of, you know, magical, mysterious power, but it's just as easily, you know, the flowers on the altar and, you know, the socks that don't have holes in them.
And the ones that do.
And the ones that do. Yeah, so thank you.
Thank you.
And the other half of that, I leave this wonderful space and I go to work and everything is chaos and nothing is in place and we're in a new administration and new computers and new files and the information is not where it should be, and I feel like I'm in a totally different world. And I'm finding that all these years of practice, I should be relaxed, you know, that my peers are handling it better than me, and I'm supposed to, you know, control my temper, and it's like, oh, geez, you know, I'm a mess. it's like, okay, this practice does not necessarily make me a kinder, more gentle, more loving, more aware of whatever the wonderful qualities that are, that this is so, well, the environment, this sort of supports, you know. Mm-hmm. And yet, so I'm in this environment, so different from here, and that's it too, and that's hard to you know, meet and not expect it, that somehow I'm going to be different in dealing with these, with the world, because I've had this wonderful experience here.
Yeah.
That meet it with the same difficulties as I did before.
I think it's a really important point that you're bringing up, and I hear two things in it. One thing I want to talk about first is that it's just an illusion that things are running smoothly here. And you know that because you're on the maintenance committee and you help out with the building, and, right? It's just like everywhere. I mean, where the officers are scrambling to, you know, who's going to do this, who's going to do that, and then boom, got to show up, right? I didn't have time even to read over this passage before the talk tonight. I read it earlier in the day. And thought, oh, that'll make a great talk. I can't wait to see what happens. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, it's 3 minutes of seven. Right? But there is this sort of way that that we have to show up for the chaos from this profound place of trusting. And even if we go out into the world, we go to work, we go to the grocery store, things seem really crazy out there because not everybody's practicing. But we're practicing, and this is the second thing that I heard. We're practicing sometimes being really, really anxious, really, really confused, really, really upset, angry, impatient, and that's irrespective of circumstances, although the circumstances can trigger them, those things. And so to learn how to see those things as this great bodhicitta, that's a transcendent coming towards us, too, in the form of anger, ill will, frustration. What if that was it? What if this is the thing you've always been looking for? No, I hate it. Right? That's what the mind says.
Right, that the protecting myself against it.
Yes.
You know, this is hard not to do.
Exactly, and the protecting yourself against it prevents you from seeing, from receiving it as the transcendent. It's a lot of energy to protect yourself from that. And I guess the last little piece I'll say is that in this practice we do grow in wisdom and compassion. It just doesn't look like what we thought it was going to look like.
And then my experience is that sometimes I am able to act with more wisdom and compassion, and sometimes I am not. And sometimes I think I am, and I'm not. And sometimes I think I'm not, and I am. So it's sort of hard to keep track of. It's hard to keep the scorecard right. I thought that was... No?
Well, and that's the thing. We're usually the last person who knows how we're doing. Everybody in our environment can let us know that, but we don't know.
Yeah. I'm obsessed right now with this ordinariness. I guess wanting to be exceptional, or that the exceptional people are the ones that like are pushing things through. They're the ones that are causing these major ripples to happen. But even in our dedication, named and unnamed, the poet that may have influenced Lin Ji. I mean, and you never know who stands behind any of these figures. Shakyamuni, he could have been influenced by who knows what kind of like little ripples that caused this huge transformation. And so, just yes, that is. That's so relieving that I don't need to be exceptional. I can just be ordinary, and that's enough. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your talk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's connected to this, the true person of no position. Because exceptional is a position we want to occupy. And it's some way we want other people to see us, right? And it's quite precarious because, maybe you are exceptional, but you got to run faster and faster to still be, so that to feel that pressure of that there's no end to, greed, anger, and ignorance are endless. And this invitation to be ordinary, to be a person without fixed position. Exceptional and ordinary are just words. Because we can also defend ordinary. Well, I'm ordinary, therefore I won't do this. An ordinary person doesn't do that. So, but in the sense you're really taking it, I think the true meaning is just to put it all down. Finally, at last, you can rest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm not exactly sure how this ties in, but somehow it really does in my mind. Because everyone's talking about the Sashin here as the calm, in the storm. And
we are
one person talking. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
Retreat in general is a slowing down time and focusing and so forth.
Sounds nice.
And I just find that this Sashin. I have a friend who's in rehab right near here, and I've been visiting her, which I normally might not do as often as I do because I come here. And then sometimes I'm doing shopping for food before I go home, and I'm just a lot more active outside of my usual routine than I usually am, because I'm coming here. And I haven't actually come to the insight on this yet, but when there was a question at the beginning of the Sesshin of why you were practicing or why you were doing this, and I had this question in my mind, well, what can I do more, or what can I offer more? And it's often seems impossible because I don't seem very reliable to myself, and look, a lot of things are happening that don't usually happen to me.
Cool. Sounds like a real session to me.
Yeah.
You know, this idealized view of a retreat is problematic because anybody who goes to a Zen retreat knows that it's actually quite arduous. You know, we're not getting enough sleep, and we have to sit for long hours, and our bodies hurt, and the food is delicious. This is an exceptional example, but often it's not, it seems like sometimes the idealized view gets in the way of realizing, oh, I'm doing this now. I'm driving back and forth, and I'm seeing my friend in rehab, and I'm going shopping, and I'm coming to sit, listening to Dharma talks. You know, that this is what life is like. But I think we have plucked away some of the not all of us have, but many of us have plucked away some of the more ordinary things that we do. But because it's a coming and going sesshin, most of us haven't. The first time we did this, I was working full time at UMass, and I remember coming home every day, and there'd be these people sitting here, and you know, I just had this, you know, like what Ray was talking about, I realized when the 3 weeks were over that the boundary between these two experiences had weakened or dissolved to some extent, and I was never the same after around seeing how ordinary life was a sesshin, you know, that somehow, and I think that's what I'm hearing a little bit in what you're saying, something's been highlighted by these interruptions, and you're actually doing more than you normally would do.
It isn't ordinary for me to do so much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's some disruptive quality,
right,
of practice, of this kind of intensive practice, and so disruption can be more or it can be less, you know, so to notice that all of us coming here, maybe coming more than we usually do, so coming every night, or you know, and I think that disruption is so important to take us into new territory.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Aaron, and then Adam.
So I was just a little curious about the last line about was it about being wrong?
You're all wrong.
What was that in reference to? I can't.
Just in general.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Whatever you're thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever you're thinking.
Whatever you're thinking. Yeah, that's sort of a Lingji thing. Stop, stop. Speak, speak. Yet you look outside, searching side paths and seeking help. You're all wrong. And, you know, and that I think really is the next line. Nope, no, it isn't. Forget it. That's just its own thing.
From my experience, it may be wrong, but like, how? No way to avoid it. You got to try it.
Absolutely. You got to try it.
You got to kind of use up all your bag of tricks.
Yeah.
Maybe. And then.
Exactly.
So it's kind of, you know, for me there's something about koan practice about just throwing shit out there.
Being wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, and eventually you kind of...
You hit the target, you throw enough. Okay, can I go to the next now?
So, I mean, there's some kind of movement or learning... through that experience, I don't think he's saying this, but you know, it feels like, well, it also doesn't mean don't do anything, because because that'll be wrong.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you gotta.
Right. Yeah, he's not saying that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I think about his youth, you know, when he was a young student, and he didn't go to Doksan for 3 years. You know, and I know people who don't go to Doksan because they're afraid of being stupid or, you know, being seen through, or right? I mean, I remember that. It's scary stuff. And then there is a sort of point when you go, oh, whatever, and you just start throwing stuff, you know, like, I don't mean literally, guys, but, you know, just, how about this? How about, no. No. Oh, that's interesting. No. Oh, I like that. That's one of James Ford's favorite things. I like that. No. No. And there is some place you reach, and he definitely reached it. You know, he keeps going into his teacher with the same question, what's the essential nature? But his teacher keeps hitting him.
Right.
And then he gives up and goes to another teacher, and you know, who says, oh, you misread it. You didn't see that hitting was grandmotherly kindness. And then he wakes up. I think this is, if you throw enough stuff at the target, you wake up.
Yeah, so I don't know. It seems like there is a place for that searching.
Yes.
Is it over here? No. Like,
yep.
Because I don't know, maybe that's how you kind of, you know, give up. Oh.
What? Otherwise, you'd just have faith. You wouldn't have
right.
doubt. Okay. Yeah. You just say, okay, if you say so.
Right.
And I never hear Linji saying that. Just believe me. He keeps saying, this is what I've experienced. Yeah. That's a really great point, Aaron.
And so his injunctions, maybe we can't really follow,
yeah.
but they're sort of tucked away somewhere. When we get desperate, or when we run out of options, oh, maybe it's in instead of out. Maybe it's here instead of there. Or we start to get curious about that. But I'm reminded too of one of Dogen's lines. He says the great way circulates everywhere, and not one of our steps leads away from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so in the midst of being wrong again and again, not away from it at all, right? So we don't have to worry about going in the right direction, because one, we're not. And two, we are.
There's no direction.
Yeah, right.
That's good. Thank you.
Yeah. I think you probably started to just answer this, but I'm kind of stewing around in confusion just from the different translations of, you know, strive under the heavens and don't strive. And,
well, that was all in one translation. He starts the paragraph saying strive, and then he says don't strive.
Yeah, and then the noble one has nothing to do, be ordinary.
Yeah.
So, just wondering.
Well, this is the disturbance that David was talking about when we were responding to these questions about Sesshin and the other world. You know, that these kinds of contradictions are disturbing. That confusion is a really important part of the path, because it disturbs our usual way of understanding the world. And when you get two completely different instructions within two lines. Mm-hmm. I got to think Linji knew what he was doing. You know, he was setting us up to say, because he does this all the time. Dogen does this all the time. All the teachers do this. They say, A, 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 and then they go, B, 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 and then they say, A is B, and then they say, A is not B. And you know, your mind is running around in circles. Because anytime we think, A, I've got it, strive, then we have a fixed view. And then when we get to B, oh, don't strive. We've got a fixed view. And it's more alive than that. Yeah. So he doesn't want us to rest in any of this stuff, except the great rest of not resting, if you know what I mean.
All of the teachers do it.
All agree.
The great teachers of the past. 2 minutes ago. And one thing I want to circle back around, because I think what you said is very relevant to a couple of things that Aaron was saying and David was saying too, Aaron, that it's really important not to buy into any of this. You know, not to say, that makes sense, yeah, but to go, what? What? No, and to try everything, like Aaron was saying, you know, that to exhaust everything. And then the common phrase that's traditional in the Tang and Sung dynasties when people had awakening experiences, they said, the Buddhas and ancestors did not deceive me. I love that, right? Because it's like, you hear all this stuff, and then you actually have an experience of something dropping away, becoming clear. Like, it makes people laugh out loud sometimes. It's so obvious in a way, and yet not. And you think, oh, that's what these guys were talking about. They haven't been playing mind games with me like I thought they were. They actually were pointing. There's some way, and you'll know it for yourself when you know it for yourself. But it won't look like knowing the way we understand it now. Yeah. So, confusion. So let's end there. Thank you, everybody.